Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Today, as you know by now, I assume, was Budget Day, Federal Budget Day, and it was about generational fairness, we were told. This was about making it better for millennials and Gen Z and asking the very, very wealthy to pay a little more. This is the talking points from the government. This is what was explained. Did this budget do that? Well, let me bring in Eric Hamm. He is a professor of economics with Toronto Metropolitan University. He joins us now. Eric, thanks for doing this today.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
Did this budget do that?
I don't think this budget did very much of anything, to be honest with you. First of all, I knew this was going to be budget light from the start because I think they've got one more in them next year before a federal election. And I think that that's where you're really going to see the big election promises coming out in the hope of buying votes. So this one is really not terribly interesting, to be honest. You know, one of the things we always say in macroeconomics is that something has to give. And they decided that they weren't going to bloat the deficit and the debt to the extent that they could have. So when you don't want that to move, you go after the tax angle. And so they've decided, let's go after some of the wealthiest people in the country. And they've increased taxes that way. They've increased inclusion on capital gains. So I call this budget light. But I think what bothers me, since it wouldn't be me on the radio without saying something that annoyed me about it, is that, you know, government spending is a way to pump the prime, as they say in economics. But I'm looking for growth. I'm looking for long-term economic growth to try to stimulate efficiencies, what we call the supply side, output per worker. And this does nothing toward that. This is just doubling down for me on what liberals do, which is tax, spend, or some combination of both, Scott. So I find this about the tax equivalent, budget equivalent of eggplant. Not that interesting.
When they say they are going to have this increase to the capital gains tax, but only for a reasonably high number for the very wealthy, is that really going to do anything? Or is that more virtue signaling to say, hey, look, we're doing something to tax the very wealthy, but we don't really want to tax them because then we'll chase them away and shut our economy down further?
And that's really true. You're right. It's very much performative. And I don't think this is going to have a great effect on anything. I mean, you're right. And mobility is stronger than people believe. We see in other countries driving billionaires and millionaires out when they start to play games with tax. Because as I actually only know one billionaire, and I won't out them, but they said, I love living in Canada. I just don't like paying taxes in Canada. So they moved the head office of their corporation. And why wouldn't they? So, you know, I've listened today and I've read what I can read. And what I keep hoping is to see something more than just trying to, in the short run, increase real GDP through government spending, because that's the equivalent of a football team running the same play over and over again until they get it right. And if you notice, they're not getting it right. There's just nothing in this budget for me that signals for me that there's a long-term growth pattern other than continuing with immigration, which I'm not against immigration. Frankly, very few Jewish people should be, but it's not a growth strategy, Scott. And let me just ramble for 30 more seconds. Nope, I completely lost my train of thought, so I'll give it back to you.
Well, okay. Among the things that were promised today that you could say would help with growth, although I'm not sure, the government promises that by 2031, it will now lead to the creation of 4 million new homes. And when I heard that, I almost thought, like, you could literally say any number and it's not going to make it happen. Is it me or am I looking at this going, there is no conceivable way on this great green earth that somehow we're building 4 million homes in the next 7 years?
Not a chance in hell, unless all of a sudden we provide incentive programs to send a great chunk of our population due north. You know, 90% of Canadians live within 90 minutes of the United States. We live in a people belt, and there isn't a chance, a snowball's chance, in you know what, they're going to be able to build those houses, affordable or not. We just don't have the space in urban areas, and people don't want to live 3, 4, 5, 6 hours away from urban centers. So I don't like this. We just keep coming back to the same themes. I mean, they said today that the debt is going to drop by half 6 or 7 years from now. Now, do you believe that? Does anybody who earns a paycheck believe that? It's never going to happen. In our lifetimes now, you're never going to see a significant drop in the debt, because that's how governments in capitalist countries these days fund their spending, and nobody does it better than Canada.
The only way our debt is starting to go back is if it works on the same metrics as a car odometer, where you hit a high enough number, it eventually reaches 000. You get high enough and suddenly it's all gone. There's no other way that spending more and having bigger deficits leads to the debt being cut. There's a logical leap that nobody can make there. So on that point, though, we learned today, and we've known this for a while, but with the new spending, we are spending $1 billion a week in this country, $54 billion a year, just to service our debt. That's money that is more than we spend on healthcare for the entire country, more than our healthcare. And, you know, I went back, Eric, when I started talking to you here, and I said that the theme here was generational fairness. I'm wondering how it's generational fairness to the Gen Z and to the millennials, that they're the ones who are going to be holding this massive debt down the road that's only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, that's going to swallow up more government money, require either cuts to programs or more taxes. How is that fair to them? They're being told we're doing this for you, and they're being handed a pile of flaming dog poop.
You put that very well. I wish I could put that in one of the papers that I write. No, you're exactly right. It doesn't do a favor to anyone. Look, the problem is that you and I and every other Canadian who has a credit card, that credit card has a limit. But our country's credit card doesn't have a limit. And now some people will say, as long as we can print our own money and we have our own central bank and our own sovereign currency so we can borrow from ourselves, it doesn't matter. That's a really strong way of thinking right now for lots of economists, and especially if they vote for liberal governments. But I'm with you. I believe in fiscal responsibility. That debt does have to be paid someday. Contrary to what post-Keynesian economists will tell you, they say, well, someday will never happen. No, that's not true. Because if you are servicing the debt, simple opportunity cost theory says, if you're going to be paying down your debt, then you're not going to be doing something else. This liberal government, you know, I'm not a big fan. They've abandoned the debt. They don't care. They just figure they're going to run it up to whatever they have to do to finance their spending. And nothing's ever been more liberal than that. I mean, this Trudeau does it, his father does it, pretty much almost every liberal government has done it. That's kind of their MO. So generationally fair, I think this budget, I think this government from COVID onward has been intergenerationally unfair. I'm out of the closet. I don't like what they did during COVID. I don't like what they've done after COVID. And to me, this is just, frankly, nothing. I am going to live as an optimist that next year, the pre-election budget will hold something more as they try to buy votes. But frankly, I'm not holding my breath, Scott.
That is Eric Kam. He is a professor of economics at Toronto Metropolitan University. As always, thank you for the time today.
Stay healthy, Scott.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
It is budget day today. It has been budget day today. Chrystia Freeland, Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, gave us the budget 2.5 hours ago. We were just talking with Eric Kam, economics professor, about what it means economically, financially to you, to the country. But what does it mean politically? Because that's the other part about this. Governments that pass a budget are hoping that it's going to enhance their standing with voters, especially a government that is having trouble right now, seemingly in the polls, like the Trudeau Liberals are. Kate Harrison is vice chair of Summit Strategies, joins us now. Kate, how are you today?
I'm doing okay, Scott. How are you?
I am doing well. I appreciate you doing this. I know every time I turn on the TV now, I see you, so I know how busy you are. I appreciate you taking time to join us. So
the government keeps messing up, so they keep having me come back on to talk about that.
Well, so at the start, when I say that every budget, the government is hoping that it will be used to enhance its standing within the vote, the eyes of the voters. Did this do that?
I think it misses the mark. The Liberals are trying very hard to recruit back support from millennials and Generation Z voters. The last couple of weeks, as your listeners might have observed, there's been a ton of announcements ahead of the budget focused on housing, focused on things like investments in AI and computing, a new national school food program, enhancements to childcare, a number of things that are really designed, at least in part, to bring these voters back in. I think, you know, now that we're at budget day, those voters and others are probably looking at that and thinking, okay, what's the so what here? How is this going to improve affordability today or tomorrow, not several years from now, when kind of the housing policies, for instance, are actually realizing their full potential and benefit? So I think that there's been a lot of lip service paid to that community, that group of voters, not a lot done to address their immediate affordability concerns. And Scott, obviously, the more the government keeps spending, the more challenging it's going to be to eliminate the deficit. Our debt servicing charges are extraordinary, $54 billion just on debt servicing. Think of where that money could go in terms of helping with services like healthcare and other things that millennial voters and others actually want to see. So I'm not sure there's immediate shiny bauble here that brings millennial voters back. And there's not, we're missing kind of the retail politics element that we're used to seeing from this government on, based on other budgets.
Well, I wasn't going to necessarily go here, but since you brought it up, we were just talking with Eric Hamm a few moments ago about the very thing, about this $54 billion a year being spent to service the debt. They pitched this as a generational fairness budget. We are going to help the younger generations, and I simply can't see how younger generations who are going to be the ones holding the bag on this enormous, enormous debt that they have to service, I don't see how this is fair. You may want to pitch it and make it a public relations thing to say we're helping you, but the reality is it seems we are maybe putting some icing on something really unpleasant that we're going to be handing to you in a few years.
Yeah, it's the lipstick on the pig, for lack of a better word. And I think the Liberals are doing what they always do, which is talking a big communications game, but then not actually backing that up with policies that people realize and see. Again, what they are committing to in terms of housing supply, for instance, you know, trying to improve affordability by longer amortization periods, for instance, these are all things that don't benefit millennials or other people today. And because of the spending problem this government has, it's an addiction to spending. Those debt servicing charges aren't going in the right direction. They've maintained a very high pace for the next number of years. And so that isn't fair to this generation or the next one that are going to be footing the bill for the very expensive spending. And it's also really challenging to ask Canadians to kind of keep paying more. We saw changes to capital gains tax. That was really the big news coming out of the budget today. And while, you know, the messaging on that is that it's impacting very few people, there's always, these things aren't, they don't happen in a bubble. There's always a downstream impact. Those are individuals that are impacted that could be job creators, that could be entrepreneurs, that might think twice about whether or not investing in Canada is the right thing to do, or if they should look at other markets that are a little more favorable in terms of their taxation. So don't let the branding fool you. The capital gains tax, it should not be viewed at in a bubble. There's a really real impact of what it means for potential investors to Canada.
Let me just read you one sentence from Chrystia Freeland's speech today as she was giving it. We're just talking about this debt and everything. Do you want to live in a country, this is her words, do you want to live in a country where we make the investments we need in healthcare and housing and old age pensions, but we lack the political will to pay for them and choose instead to pass a ballooning debt onto our children? I wasn't sure when I heard that if she had been handed Pierre Poilievre's speech by accident and was reading. It's so unironic. And yet this is exactly what you're doing. And now we're going to play, okay, but if I tell you that we're not, maybe you'll believe. Anyway, let's go to the capital gains thing for a second here, because the one thing they did do or didn't do, there had been rumors for the last number of days leading up to this, when we heard about this generational fairness term, that there might either be capital gains tax put on the sale of primary residences or an inheritance tax. They didn't do either of those things. The fact that the rumors were out there, but they didn't do that, are people then going to give a sigh of relief and say, oh, this is actually better than I thought then?
No, I really don't think, Scott, that people were looking at this government and saying we have a tax problem. I think they were looking at the government and saying we have a spending problem. So it's not an inheritance tax or a primary residence tax, either of those political suicides for this government or any government, in my opinion. They also didn't do a windfall tax or an excess profit tax. They didn't change the corporate tax rate. So there's a bunch of things they didn't do that could have taxed the truly wealthy. What they've done instead is focus on capital gains. And again, those that are, well, it's being messaged as the wealthiest individuals paying. You are talking still about job creators and individuals that could decide to move their small business, for instance, elsewhere because of this measure. So I'm not expecting that a lot of Canadians are going to shed a tear for, you know, 0.13% of impacted Canadians. But you have to think about the big picture in terms of the signal this sends. And corporations might be willing to pay a bit more. Business people might be willing to pay a bit more if they thought that they were in this fight with the government. But instead, the government is pitting their expenditures against business investment, prioritizing their spending over the ability of private sector to get ahead. And that's what really chafes private sector and business. They want to see the government taking action to reduce their own spending. And yeah, if it means that there is a focus on them paying more too, then that's something that they would have to grapple with and deal with. But the problem is that the Liberals just keep spending and taxing to pay for that spending rather than doing the hard work of trying to reduce their own government spending.
There was a tweet that came out, because it's not just the Liberals that are involved in this, obviously. There was a tweet that came out at 4:16, so halfway through or a quarter of the way through the budget announcement today. It was from Jagmeet Singh. The conservative handouts will continue. Justin Trudeau will keep Pierre Poilievre's $60 billion in taxpayer handouts to corporations. Thanks to Pierre and Justin, it's a good day for greedy Galen Weston and a bad day for you. Is it me or has Jagmeet Singh almost become a cartoon character at this point that he is the only person, if what the Liberals are doing is so bad, he is the only person that could get them to not be able to do it by stopping it, and yet he doesn't. And then complains. To me, he's become satire. When he opens his mouth, it's vacuous pap at this point. It means nothing. He says nothing. He's become a joke.
Yeah, there's very little credibility behind that statement when, to your exact point, Scott, the NDP are the party that could bring down the government tomorrow. So one thing to try and draw a contrast with your words, it's another thing to actually put that into action and force the government into an election. The NDP is the only party that really has the ability to do that. So the thing is out today saying they're looking for a little more clarity. They want to see a few tweaks and tinkering with the margins of this budget, and then they'll likely very well vote for it. We should very much keep in mind that the reason the government is still propped up is because Jagmeet Singh is concerned about one thing. It's his own political survivability. That's why the supply and confidence agreement exists. He knows that he either loses now or loses later. And I think for a lot of voters that want to see contrast on the left, they want to see a real progressive option to Justin Trudeau, because those voters are certainly out there. They're not getting that with Jagmeet Singh. Mm. And the longer this agreement goes on, the longer Singh continues to saddle up to Trudeau. Drawing that contrast is going to be even more challenging, and that will be a killer for his party and his government in the next election, because they won't be able to distinguish themselves from the failing Liberal Party.
We're really short on time, but thanks for raising that, because I want to ask about that. When we do have an election, whenever it is, normally, I would think that Trudeau and Singh, assuming they're both still in their positions, would be firing all their bullets at Pierre Poilievre because he's leading. But it seems to me that because Singh and Trudeau have been so tied at the hip, they're going to have to spend an awful lot of their time firing at each other to try and separate themselves for those Liberal, small L Liberal voters. Which, is that not going to just play perfectly for Poilievre?
Yeah, there's a number of ridings where Liberal and NDP fights can actually result in the Conservatives coming right up the middle. I think the other realistic challenge, Scott, that the Liberals and the NDP are going to have is candidate recruitment. The NDP has had at least 25% of their current caucus say that they don't intend to run again. I think a lot of Liberals are holding their breath and seeing how this budget lands, frankly, to determine whether or not they will re-up for the next election. They have very few nominated candidates as it stands, I think less than 30%. So there's going to be real logistical challenges for both those parties heading into the next election, and trying to draw that contrast between one another is going to be just one of the many things that they have to grapple with.
That is Kate Harrison. She is the vice chair of Summit Strategies. Kate, always appreciate you taking your time to do this. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
For those of us who spent too much time, although I'm guessing my next guest, as I said a moment ago, will say, too much time? No such thing as too much time when it was watching much music. But for those of us who spent, let's say, a lot of hours, you'll know that reference. You'll know who Bill is. Bill, who's joining me now, Bill Walinczka, he was the host on Much Music of Outlaws and Heroes. He did a bunch of other shows in there for years. He is now the author of a new book that is out, A Happy Has-Been. He joins us now. Bill, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. And I haven't heard The Rock mention my name in a long time.
Well, you know, if you're going to have people mention your name, that's not the worst one.
That's a good one. That's a pretty good one. I remember that interview. He laid into me with a typical Rock insult. That was some good television there. But currently I'm hanging out in Cambridge at the Indigo, and tomorrow I'll be in Burlington, right next door to you guys.
Absolutely. From, I think it's 11 till 2 tomorrow?
Yes, that's correct.
11 to 2 at the Burlington Indigo, signing the new book, A Happy Has-Been. And I know that this has been brought up to you many times before, but you know, if you're a has-been, the rest of us are in trouble. What's with the name of the book?
I explain it in the book, but it all relates to the fact that, you know, I did my career backwards. So I started off in Toronto at this national level in the major market, and I slowly wound myself down to a smaller market, a local audience. I'm still working in television and now radio. But I think if you were to mention my name now to someone in, like, I don't know, Lethbridge, Alberta, and they'd say, oh, Bill Walinczka, yeah, I remember that guy. Is he dead? Whatever happened to him? So I think it sort of plays into that. It's self-deprecating. I'm
of course
aware of that. But also, you know, there are people that have followed my career, which just surprises the heck out of me that people would care enough. And it surprises the heck out of me that this book has come along and it's reminding people about time in their lives that they cherish and that they miss, and it's really hit that nostalgia nerve.
You know,
my mind, and I am so humbled and grateful for it.
Bill, one of the so last time I saw Bill, and he didn't see me at this time, he has no idea who I am, but that's okay. Last time I saw you was at Roy Thompson Hall at the screening for 299 Queen Street West, which was a terrific documentary directed by Hamilton's Sean Menard, who and Bill was there on stage, and there were a bunch of other former VJs, Erica M and Michael Williams and Hamilton's Rick Campanelli and Steve Anthony and a bunch of others. And you talk about the, you know, looking back. It seems like Much Music is having a bit of a moment right now as far as people remembering those times.
What I've realized is this past year is I think people need, and I've known this for a while though, but it's really hit home the past year or so. You need 10, 15, maybe 20 years away from something to regard it in a very fond manner. You know, like in the 80s, the 70s were ridiculous. Bell bottoms, what the hell? But then again, in the 90s, the 70s were cool. You know, so I think Much Music has sort of, as we knew it, has been away and gone long enough now that the people that really enjoyed it have kids.
Yep.
And they tell their kids about Much Music, and the kids can't believe it because they want to watch a music video. They go to YouTube. But there was this magic that was created across Canada, and it fed this, you know, new Canadian star system as far as the music business was concerned. And it wasn't like MTV. We dealt with issues as well, like LGBTQ issues and literacy and race relations. And so Much Music really did set itself apart from just being an entertainment channel. And I think people miss that now.
I do too. And I think that the other thing is that if you were going to start that today, even if Moses Neimer was again going to be the guy, kind of a, you know, a visionary and a guy who did things outside the box.
Absolutely.
But even then, it would be more corporate today. I don't remember the exact story. I just remember as part of that documentary, you arrived as a VJ on that station, and you're going to have to fill me in on the details, but you did not exactly follow like the broadcaster training path, right? You landed there in a weird way, right?
Well, I started off, I was hired as an editor right out of radio, okay, television broadcasting college, I think the same week I graduated. And I sort of fell into the on-air stuff. And, you know, I look at that time as, you know, I was never the cute one. I was never the...
You had pretty good hair.
One. I was never the political one. What you saw was someone that loved doing interviews and loved creating television. And, there was no real training to how to act or how to behave. As long as you loved music and understood music, then you could talk and you could relate and not necessarily talk down to the viewer, because I don't like that. You know, I'm speaking with them. I'm one of them. I'm a music fan too. And look at me interviewing all my favorite artists and thanks so much for watching. So yeah, I think it could happen again. I know some of the specials that I put on my YouTube channel, they get thousands and thousands of hits. So don't tell me, oh, it wouldn't work today. People have short attention spans. I think people miss good music journalism. Mm. And sadly, that's missing now.
It is amazing, though, to think that someone, as you say, could sort of come out of university, come out of college and land there, end up on TV as an on-air host. And then, as you say, like I was watching today, there's a montage on your website. There's a montage of photos of people that you were interviewing. And it's like, it's a stunning thing when you look back to think, wow, the people that came in there that you got to talk to as just a guy sitting in a studio talking to these people is pretty remarkable.
Well, and that's the cool thing about Much, too. I forgot to mention that with MTV, you know, black artists weren't playing his first couple of years. Like, what's going on here? And with Much, in the course of an hour, you would see some hip-hop. You would see some pop. You know, there was a time where we played country music videos. We played alternative. We played, you know, there was something for everyone. And everyone was welcome to the party. And it was inclusive. It wasn't exclusive. And it's, you know, what a time. And again, how fortunate and how cool and how humbled am I to be there to experience all this as a music fan, as well as working in television.
Was there anybody that they told you, hey, so-and-so is coming in today, and you kind of gulped hard and said, wait, I got to talk to this person? Not because it was a bad thing, just because how am I going to hold my own talking to this person or they're such a star? That ever happened with you, or were you totally, totally chill the whole time?
It was always a job, so you have to get stuff out, and you have to, you know, make it fun for the artist, make it obviously good for the viewer. But there's been so many times where, you know, in grade school, having a jean jacket with all my patches on the back and buttons, you know, an Ozzy Osbourne patch, and then there I just spent 4 days with Ozzy, hanging around with him on his private jet, or I'm a huge fan of The Cure. And there I am interviewing Robert Smith and spending like an hour with him. And he's handing me the set list to see what songs I can tell my cameraman to tape. And, you know, but it's not until they leave the room where I'm like, that was way cool, man. That was so cool. Because at the time, it's a job and you have to get the good stuff out. But it's not until, like I said, when I'm helping put the camera away with the cameraman that I'm thinking, this is the best job in the world.
Yeah, and you know what, one of the things, and I know that people have talked about this, musicians have talked about this over the years, that if you watch Spinal Tap, and I'm sure most people have watched Spinal Tap, there is a musician's interview that you can, it's way too serious, it's way, taking themselves way too seriously, and sometimes I watched old, you know, when you would watch Much Music, and you go, do they really think like this, or, and it seems like it's like the hardest thing for an interviewer to do when someone has decided they are the deepest soul on planet Earth, and their three-chord music is telling something to the world that no one else could possibly know, and that's tough to navigate through when you're doing that interview.
And you know, what's interesting is that it doesn't matter who the person is that you're interviewing. I'm not a big fan of Marilyn Manson. You know, I don't go home and listen to Marilyn Manson. I like the music. I just don't respect his politics. And, you know, but you know that there's someone out there watching that loves Marilyn Manson. And so it's not up to me to, you know, take the interview one way or the other. I'm there for them. I'm there for the viewer. I'm just simply a conduit between the viewer and the artist. and telling their story. And basically, I've been doing that for 35 years. So everything I've learned then, I'm still applying now.
One of the things, again, watching 299 Queen Street West, and it's hard to find these days. I think it was supposed to be on Crave, and it's not, but that's a long story that we won't get into. But watching
legalities and lawyer stuff.
Watching that documentary, and then I didn't realize where it was going to go. I didn't know where that was going to navigate. But it's clear that there is some real, not from you, not from the other VJs, but there is some regret, I guess, about how that ended, and that the fact that it did end, that there's, that much music is not much music. It's gone now. Do you look back and go, man, I really wish that thing was still there?
I have mixed feelings about it. I think towards the end, the beginning of the end for me and why I left was an introduction of a tabloid style of presentation of the music. I remember coming back with a Bowie interview that I was going to use for a 1-hour special when I had jumped to much more music. And the boss at the time says, oh, Bowie, I don't know if that's going to get ratings. You think it's going to get ratings? And I thought, okay, I'm done here. I'm done. I'm pretty much done here. If I have to explain to my boss the importance of David Bowie, yeah, I shouldn't have to do that. And then you started seeing less and less good interviews. It was all about, you know, who's got cellulite, who's in rehab, who broke up with who, and this was what we were covering. And so I think the beginning of the end was when CTV Bell came in and bought it from Chum. And to me, that was sort of the beginning of the end. And I was proven right, because it went from, you know, huge, massive people on this, massive crowds on the street. And I remember there was a shot in the dock of sort of, as it was on its way out, there was like 12 people looking through the window in this giant exterior. And I thought, that's pretty much what happens when you take something over, try to do something with it that is moving away from its original intent. It's going to fail.
I will, whenever I think of how important or how impactful Much Music was, and this is a weird example, I understand, but people who are of my era will remember this. There was, when Michael Jackson's Thriller video was going to debut, Much Music had like a countdown clock in the corner, like it was a rocket launch that was going off from NASA. Yeah. And for hours, and we didn't have YouTube back then. We didn't have these things. And everybody at that assigned time was tuned in, because that was the one place that you were going to see this. And it was a huge, huge deal for music and style and culture and all those kind of things, fashion. There just isn't anything like that now, I don't think. Maybe I'm just old and missing something, but no, I don't think there's anything like it.
We did the same with Backstreet Boys videos too, or NSYNC videos, for that portion of the audience that couldn't wait to see the new video. And doing this book tour, talking to a lot of parents that bring their kids, and the parents explain, you know, when I was your age, my God, I sound old, I'm sorry. when I was your age, this was how we consumed music. This is how we learned about artists, is watching Much Music. And the kid looks up at the mom and says, well, Mom, you just go to YouTube. It's like, well, no, it didn't exist. Computers didn't exist. And for those parents that, you know, have kids and they try to explain it, I think it brings back fond memories, and it brings back a time and place that they like to visit. And the past year for me, it's like, you know, I don't mind looking back. I don't want to live in the past, but I don't mind looking back, especially when I hear comments from people about what it meant to them, or what an interview of mine meant to them. Or the biggest compliments I've heard is, I got introduced to Liz Phair because of you, or I got introduced to The Cure because of you, or I became a fan of Oasis because of your specials.
Mm.
It's like, wow, you don't think of it at the time. It doesn't really register. Until years later, again, you need that separation from it where you realize, you know what, it was really freaking cool.
Any of the parents that come and talk to you about this, any of them admit that they danced on Electric Circus?
I've heard that, yes. Yeah.
And, that's a brave person to admit it now in their middle age. But
again, it's okay now, because back then, you know, no one, you know, Monica had a great quote. If everyone's saying they don't watch the show, they don't know about it, why is every cab driver in Toronto asking me about it? But, you know, but again, you need that time away from it to look back fondly.
It is, I can't wait to read the book. I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to get it. I'm going to read it. It's called A Happy Has-Been by Bill Walichka. Exciting times and lessons learned by one of Canada's foremost entertainment journalists. Looks like a great book, Bill. And as I say, I will be grabbing a copy. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate you taking a few minutes.
Thank you. It means a lot. Thank you.
Tomorrow in Burlington from 11 till 2 at the Brant, the Indigo on Brant Street is where you can find Bill to get a copy of that book, correct?
Yes, that's
perfect.
Absolutely correct.
Really appreciate it, Bill. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much. Be well. Take care. Thank you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
There have been a few Canadians over the years who have been born to run. Donovan Bailey, of course, Desai Williams, Glenroy Gilbert. We can go down the list. There's a whole bunch of them that at one time or another, Angela Issayenko, I mean, the names start popping out. Just I wasn't even thinking about it. And all of a sudden, they come right back to the top of your mind. But at the top of that list, I would suggest, is Ben Johnson. There is no other track athlete probably in the history of this country who is as fascinating and as complicated as Ben Johnson. And he is the subject of a new book, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson, World's Fastest Man. It's written by Mary Ormsby, longtime fantastic columnist with the Toronto Sun, who has written this book now. She joins us now. Mary, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks, Scott. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I appreciate you doing this, and I can't wait to read this book. I read a number of years ago a book by... Now I'm forgetting his name. He was a British author who wrote about the dirtiest race in history and how all the, I think 6 of the 8 guys who lined up in Seoul for that final at the Olympics at one time or another tested positive or had some drug thing. I mean, this is, Ben Johnson is the guy with good reason who gets all the criticism and all the flack. And as I say, with good reason, but he was hardly alone at that time, right?
No, you're absolutely correct. And back in 1988 in that race, 6 of the 8 men eventually went on to become linked directly or indirectly to drug violations. It wasn't all steroid use, but you know, close enough. But Ben was singled out in Seoul. And in fact, he was the only track and field athlete at the Seoul Olympics to fail a drug test. The only person. So you know, he's in a category, you know, all alone, quite unique, even in that respect. But as you said, he's compelling and fascinating. And there's always been a wisp of mystery, really, about what happened in Seoul and how he was treated. And did we miss anything? Because we were so quick to judge him back in the day, because it was also new and so shocking. And it was seemed like an open and shut case. Well, this guy's a cheater and he's no good and we're just all going to forget he ever even existed. But when we, you know, over the course of time, I began sort of, you know, I became sort of friendly with Ben. I would do stories, you know, every anniversary, the 10th, 20th anniversary of the Seoul Olympics. And then I began asking questions about Seoul. And that got me thinking to, you know, maybe I should dig back into, you know, that time. And I came away with an idea that I thought, well, when his rushed hearing in Seoul, when he was trying to clear himself from the, you know, the doping violation, it was a very rushed process. And for a lot of other reasons, too, I believe he was denied due process. And that's something we examine in the book, because although he eventually did admit under oath that, yes, I was using steroids. But is it possible to railroad a guilty man if he did not receive due process as part of his fair hearing or supposed fair hearing?
Knowing you were coming on, I was trying to think down a mental list of moments in Canadian sports that were as that brought people as much joy as that win that night, if Saturday night, as I recall. But anyway, and I mean, you know, Paul Henderson would be there, and Joe Carter hitting the home run, and there are a few, but there's not very many, I don't think, that elicited the kind of countrywide euphoria that him beating Carl Lewis that night brought.
I would agree, because you know I was so fortunate. I was there in Seoul. I was in the stands and I got to watch a pretty good race, a race of the ages. And with Ben John, he actually won that race, the first step out of the blocks, because his start was his magic weapon. And he was able to run that race in world record time and still slow down to turn his head
Yeah.
and taunt Carl Lewis as he crossed the finish line with his, you know, hand in the air, signaling number one.
Which we all loved, by the way, that he taunted.
Oh,
we all loved that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for Canadians, like, oh, that is so cheeky. Way to go. A very, very iconic. And, you know, and that's why I think it's seared into so many minds if you actually were able to see it in real time.
So was the high, here's one, you've probably thought about this, was the high of Ben Johnson winning higher than the low was low of him having that announcement 48 hours later? You know what I'm getting at? Like, was the greatness of it more than the lowness of it afterwards?
I think they go hand in hand, and it is a draw because he produced, as you just said, the greatest high and the greatest low in Olympic history. And as part of that, not only did he shake up the nation of Canada, he shook up really the international view as to how we view doping in sport. Because back in those days, this was all sort of new to people. Nobody knew what all the drug secrets were of athletes, not just in track and field, but across the spectrum, you know, all kinds of sports, because it was a bit of the Wild West, because, you know, testing was so, you know, infrequent, and you kind of knew when you were going to be tested. It was usually on a competition day. So from that, too, the doping, the war on doping athletes really did sort of pick up the pace, and they, you know, the powers that be became a little more aware of what they had to do to keep the sport more clean.
You've written about it. So one of the fascinating stories that we heard around the time, and then it sort of disappeared because he admitted at the Dubin inquiry, but we always heard this story that there was somebody from Carl Lewis or some American's camp who was in the doping room who spiked his drink with, what was it, sassafras? Or, I mean, I can't, some crazy thing that, and what's the story, what is the real story behind that?
Well, at the time, that was all Ben Johnson and his coach Charlie Francis could think of. You know, Ben went into the doping control room after the race, as you know, the top three finishers, medalists were chosen, and you give a urine sample, and I believe there might have been a fourth at random in that particular race. But they go in there, and you're only supposed to bring one person with you, the athletes, and Ben chose his massage therapist. Charlie couldn't even get in, so it was supposed to be strict. But he walks in to the little, you know, unit area where he's supposed to be waiting to give his test, and there was this American guy sitting on the ground, and Ben didn't bother to ask his name and didn't remember him from before. But this guy was chatting with him, and Ben was getting him to pass, you know, beers from the little cooler there because Ben was dehydrated and couldn't give a sample right away. And he, you know, hammered back like six or eight beers or something. Anyway, when the, you know, what hit the fan, all he could think of was, well, this guy was in doping control with me. Maybe it was, you know, the mystery man, the stranger. He must have spiked my beer with pills, steroids. And that was sort of his only defense, because he couldn't tell anybody, hey, I stopped using steroids, you know, 3 weeks ago, the way I have for the last 8 years. Because, you know, they were all relatively sophisticated steroid users, and they would not have used those drugs anywhere close to the race day. So that's all they could think of. So that was where that he spiked my beer. Mm. And the man you're talking about, we found out later on that he was a friend of Carl Lewis, but he was kind of sent in there by Carl Lewis's manager to keep an eye on Ben, not to do anything nefarious, but to, you know, just make sure he didn't do anything funny or, you know, no shenanigans with him trying to hide a clean urine sample. So that's kind of the long and convoluted explanation I've just given you for this man being there. And it took some months for the Canadians, including Ben and Charlie, to realize that this guy was a friend of Carl Lewis and his name was Andre Jackson.
With all this stuff that you're put together for the book, there has to be, you have to have had some long conversations with Ben Johnson about this. Is he at this point easy, happy to talk about these times in his life, or is this something that still is a little bit like pulling teeth? Because I got to imagine that, again, for him, it's probably not the, you know, it's well, not probably, it is certainly not the high point of his life. Is it something he talks about easily, or it's really a challenge to get it out of him?
Well, I can back up a little bit by saying, you know, Ben was the one who asked me to do the book.
Oh,
And I
okay.
said no at first. I said, oh, no, I can't. I've never written a book and I couldn't do it. I'm busy. I work. I have four kids, blah, 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 blah. But eventually I said yes. I just felt there was some sort of historical injustice that maybe, you know, we should really have a better look at. So that was kind of like my motivation too. Plus, you know, with him, it's like all humans, he's complicated. So he's still resentful and angry about what happened to his soul because he felt he was unfairly singled out and probably set up in his mind. That's his take on it. But here we are, he's a man in his 60s now, and
Wow.
he was excellent to work with. I will tell you, he was good talking about it. There were clearly times, deep, difficult, painful areas that he would go into, and a couple of times he broke down. It was hard. So he was about as honest and raw a person as I've ever sort of dealt with on a long-term basis, because we worked together over about 2 years to put this book together. And he probably sat down for about 25 or 20, you know, 30 hours of formal interviews, but he was also very good about providing files and documents and you know, leads to other people in his life. So he's you know, he was a delight really to work with.
You kind of blew my mind for a second there when you said he's in his 60s now. That just is I mean, it's unbelievable because he is, because of that race, he is one of those people, almost like Elvis or Marilyn or someone, who is forever etched in our mind at a certain age. You don't think of him as being, well, you may because you've been with him, but the rest of us, he is forever that guy in the red singlet in Seoul.
That's an excellent point, and I agree with you. It's like a time warp, right?
Yes,
That
yes.
you just don't see him any other way than, you know, this fabulous athlete in from 1988. And as you were talking at the top there, that all these memories come flooding back, names and places and dates and where you were, who you were with when you were, you know, watching the race. I get that response a lot from people. And they're from all ages. I mean, they're older than me, and there are kids who come up to me and say, you know, I was in grade school when I saw that race, and I can still remember blah, 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 blah. So it's one of those memories and those times, because it was such an emotional high and low over a short period of time, that's just like really just seared into everybody's minds, especially Canadians.
What's his relationship, if at all, with Donovan Bailey? Because I've always thought that Donovan Bailey unfairly, because there was never a whiff of steroids that I've ever heard around Donovan Bailey. I've always thought that he never got the full credit that he deserved, because we all, as Canadians, after the Dubin Inquiry, after Ben Johnson, all just kept waiting for the shoe to drop as, oh man, when's the thing coming? There never was. But I wonder if Donovan Bailey and Ben Johnson have any kind of relationship.
You know, you'd probably have to ask either one of those guys about that. I don't think they're buddy buddy. I don't think they sort of hang out, but Ben's quite a bit older than Donovan too. But I will say, with some athletes, like I know it was difficult for Bruni Surin too. He was the Canadian champion after Ben kind of blew up. Ben's, you know, his whole aura cast this huge shadow on Canadian male sprinters for a very long time, and I could see how you know, younger runners and guys coming up after Ben were just like, oh my God, we just stop with the Ben Johnson comparisons. Like, why do I have to keep talking about him? And that was a thing they had to face quite a bit. So I can see if there was some annoyance at all with any other runners about Ben. And it's not really Ben's fault, but he was often, they were, you know, he just kind of like was this huge presence that people had to redeem the country by running fast and having people forget about Ben Johnson. That was a thing for quite a long time.
Yeah, because I expect that every good runner, every good Canadian runner after him, we all thought that. Anyone who had success, I think, just by almost sort of self-defense for our own emotions, is like, okay, I can't get too attached to this person because what if they have the same thing? And
Yeah, and that's unfair too to them, isn't
of
it?
course it
Right.
is, of
Especially all those
course.
guys and women who have all passed their tests, and there's never an issue. So it's been unfair to them to have to sort of answer for someone maybe they've never even met.
One of the interesting things, we only have a couple of minutes left here. One of the really interesting things about this is as I was thinking about this today, I can't remember the last time I've seen Ben Johnson in public. Is it an intentional thing that he has really been I'm not going to say a hermit, but I mean, really not in public a lot?
No, I don't think so. But part of that, Scott, is because, you know, he did fail another drug test in 1993. And that's another story for another day, and was banned for life based on that. So, you know, because of Seoul and a second failed drug test that he eventually was, you know, sort of exonerated over later. But that, lifetime ban stays in place. So he cannot work in track and field at all for life. So he has been trying to scrape together, a living by doing appearances and building a personal coaching career, you know, a trainer, conditioning guy you can hire. And he's just a quiet guy himself. So he's no longer hanging out with the Maradona types anymore, as he was in the 90s when he was coaching Maradona. But he's doing, a lot of youth, soccer, hockey kids, lacrosse, and some track kids, but away from the track. So he's got a busy life that way, staying in the sport in his own way, but still hopes to get back. He still hopes to clear his name.
Will that happen?
He's working on it. You know, he's gone to the courts a few times, and he's, you know, might have something, going on now, under the radar. And we'll see how that goes. But I'm also wondering, I'm hoping that this book might open some minds to, you know, does Ben deserve a reexamination, a review, some sort of restorative justice for how he was treated in Seoul? You know, will someone be willing to go back and have a look and say, you know what, this man was deprived or denied of due process in Seoul, and maybe there's some way to make that right?
Well, considering how many athletes in a variety of sports have tested positive for this or that or the other and have been welcomed back, it does seem unusual. Now, I know Ben Johnson had the second positive test, so that there's that. But it does seem odd that all of them seem to be able to come back and he remains the pariah. It is weird.
It is weird, and it's an older time too, right? So just very quickly, you know, those are the old rules in the 80s and early 90s, and then when the WADA came in, the World Anti-Doping Agency, in the year 2000, it's like a new, more sophisticated way to look after doping around the world for athletes. So I don't know if Ben's just been forgotten, being part of an old-time kind of anti-doping villain, I suppose.
Well, there is a Facebook page that I believe is his. It's got the blue check mark for Ben Johnson. And the intro says, former Olympic athlete and sprinter, now a businessman and professional trainer. There's no fairness in sports. Kind of says an awful lot right there in how he sees things. The book is called World Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. We've been talking to Mary Ormsby, who is the author of it. Really appreciate taking time. I can't wait to get my hands on this book. It sounds fantastic. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening. And do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.